wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM in Portland, Oregon. This is Norm Diamond, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Patricia Kullberg is our producer. One of the things we do here at the Old Mole's underground burrow is celebrate. We celebrate victories toward a better society, of course, but we also celebrate struggle toward that end, whether it brings us immediate victory or not. We grow in struggle. We develop our sense of capabilities and our understanding. We test out possibilities and expand our sense of what we'd like to achieve. It's not only that we have to struggle in order to win, true as that is, it's also that we become the kind of people capable of winning, capable of building something fundamentally better, only through struggle. So, let's celebrate. Today is the 102nd anniversary of the Great Seattle General Strike. Workers in that heavily unionized city didn't simply stay home from work on strike. They took over and ran the city. They decided what essential services and businesses would continue and what would shut down. They provided security for a suddenly crimeless city and kept the police off the streets, closeted in their station houses. They did this as a multiracial, coordinated workforce, women and men alike. Most importantly, they showed themselves and us that workers are fully capable of running things, of redesigning a society that's equitable and inclusive, participatory, and fulfilling. I've done entire programs on KBOO on the Seattle General Strike, so I won't say more now, except that the inspiration it provides is worth our celebrating. We also celebrate Black History Month. Listen in particular next week when Luisa Martinez looks back at the life of Ben Fletcher, superb organizer on the docks and leader of a racially integrated IWW Longshore Union local. Luisa also joins me today for a conversation about Che Guevara's Socialism and Man in Cuba. What does Che think about the role of struggle in creating the new person who will flourish in a socialist society? Before that, Bill Resnick talks with Al Weinrub, coordinator of the California Alliance for Community Energy, and Joe Clement interviews Marianne Garneau, whose online journal, Organizing Work, is a thoughtful resource for workplace activists. Joe?
I'm joined by Marianne Garneau. Marianne, thanks for coming on the Old Mole again.
Thanks for having me back.
If you've listened to the Old Mole a lot, you've probably heard me in the last few years have Marianne come on to talk about labor organizing. She is an organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World in New York and is currently the chair of their education department board and is the editor of a web publication called Organizing Work. And the website for that is just organizing.work. I brought her on today to talk about an article that she wrote late last year, but which is still timely, about big strikes and the sabotage of labor. It's a very thought-provoking article about the history of workers' power in this country and how it's changed, and what we might look to that as far as reviving the effective power that workers have. I'd like to start out by just reading the opening section, which sets up the larger piece, and then we will talk about it. In the last couple of years, a new article of faith has emerged in left labor circles, the need to bring back the big strike. Such was the focus of Joe Byrne's Reviving the Strike, Eric Loomis's A History of America in 10 Strikes, and Jeremy Brecher's recently republished Strike. But it is also now the line pushed by virtually every labor luminary. It's the centerpiece of Jane McAlevey's recently concluded Strike School, Sarah Nelson's slow-burning campaign for head of the AFL-CIO has involved talking up the possibility of a general strike among airport workers, and there's a steady stream of op-eds advancing this line in Labor Notes, The Nation, Jacobin, and In These Times. The large-scale strikes in recent years in both private and public sectors, like Bath Iron Works, Marriott, Chicago Teachers Union, the West Virginia Teachers, Stop and Shop, are all written up excitedly as what the labor movement needs more of. Of course, this goal is laudable. Nobody thinks workers shouldn't strike. It's an exertion of class power, and it results in better contracts and possibly even moving the needle on broader social issues, not to mention increasing the confidence of the working class to wage a class struggle. The point that we have to return to the days when workers exerted punitive withdrawals of their labor and exhibited broad working class solidarity, even if it means defying the law, are well taken. However, I want to question the narrative that the big strike is itself the key to reviving worker militancy, which is exactly the promise being made by all these figures. I want to argue that the singular focus of the all-out strike has to be understood within a horizon in which we have retreated from shop floor control over the workplace to bargaining every few years over wages and benefits. Polemically, I want to argue that the historical context for the emphasis on the big strike is the retreat from these fights on the work floor, which I take to be integral to developing the struggle capacity of the working class. If you take a look back at the previous peaks of labor militancy that the left labor theorists lionize, there was a completely different attitude, unrecognizable today, about what fights needed to be waged and where. Workers then prioritized struggles over the day-to-day control of work and insisted on settling these and other issues on the floor. In some ways, the arc of 20th century labor history is the displacement of a labor politics that prioritized worker control on the job, a push for the big strikes without an at least equally strong emphasis, in practice and not just rhetoric, on reinvigorating shop floor struggle is like demanding a wheel without an axle. So I want to start out just asking you to kind of offer a bit more context, if people haven't run into it, with what the narrative of the big strike is, both today and historically.
Yeah, so I mean, I really am responding to a phenomenon that I think you can see on the labor left today, or among people who are excited about reviving labor's capacity, where people, and rightfully so, have criticisms of the passive state that a lot of unions have fallen into. They've stopped being fighting unions. They've turned into more kind of like, you know, insurance agencies, as they say, or they have a bit of a passive attitude towards management instead of a fighting attitude. And so a lot of people have been saying for the last couple of decades, last couple of years especially, we need to bring back the kind of union that fights. And first and foremost, that's conceived of in terms of the strike, you know, the big all-out strike, the thing that we've kind of recognized the most as the deployment of worker power, where the entire workforce votes to stop working, they go out, they maintain a picket line, they try to prevent people from crossing it while in bargaining at the bargaining table. And I just did this little sort of historical tour where I found out that thinking of labor activity and militancy in exclusively those terms is kind of a recent historical phenomenon. We used to think of labor activity and worker fight and worker struggle in rather different terms. And it's unfortunate that we now only have this one way of imagining worker power. I think a lot has been lost in that.
So you allude to this common story about the decline of worker militancy in the labor movement, which normally focuses on the purging of Reds and other radicals from the unions. And in some more advanced versions of this story, there's some reference to how the Taft-Hartley Act really accelerated this and attacked worker solidarity. But you make the point that the compromises that have led to the decline in worker militancy began in important ways much earlier in the accumulated compromises with the employing class in the form of contracts, and how contracts led to trade-offs over shop floor power. Can you define shop floor struggle and put it in context with the other ways workers have sought to challenge their bosses or change their workplaces?
So basically, nowadays, the way that we all kind of tend to imagine unions is that workers have a union on the job. If they have issues, grievances, as we call them, they can use the union to move through the grievance process, which usually ends in arbitration. And that's something that takes place kind of between the union and the employer's representatives. And then once in a while, you get to renegotiate your collective bargaining agreement and maybe try to push for something like higher wages, or maybe face rollbacks, or try to improve your benefits, and so on. what we used to struggle over as a labor movement was much more expansive than that and had a lot more to do with what the day-to-day pace of work was like and the day-to-day conditions of work were like. So things that are generally kind of considered slightly outside of the scope of bargaining nowadays and grievances nowadays used to be the things that the working class was concerned about the most. What they wanted the most was control over the job on a day-to-day basis, and that's what they fought with their employers about in a very immediate and direct fashion. So the way that that relates to what you were saying in the preface to that question about, you know, why did the labor movement decline? Why has it been in this steady decline since, you know, the 1970s, so like 50 years now? Often the story that gets told is you had the passage of the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, and that finally opened up space for workers to organize, and that was a boon to the labor movement. And then, in part perhaps due to the Cold War in 1947, the government passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which did constrain union activity, but which also purged communists from unions. And once you got rid of that more radical leadership in the unions, they lost their fighting spirit and started their decline. Whereas the story that I am telling is that the legal and formal processes that unions had been funneled into, starting with the Labor Relations Act in 1935, slowly and surely moved fights off the work floor and into, you know, let's say conference rooms between employers and union representatives, and slowly kind of like bureaucratized unions and the labor movement. And it was not simply, or even first and foremost, a matter of purging radicals. It was a matter of kind of conditioning and disciplining unions to act in this so-called, you know, rational, reasonable way.
So why do you think, or why can we look to history and see unions make this trade-off or accept these terms? You know, we do look at that history and see that it was a huge improvement for the working class and led to, you know, fundamental transformations of our economy that, even if they're under attack, still live with us today. What was the, you know, the bargain that we were making with the devil at that time?
So this article is a historical piece, and I'm leaning on the work of five or six fairly high-profile labor historians. But one of them, Melvin Dubovsky, said that the Treaty of Detroit, it was in 1950, signed between UAW and General Motors. It was a five-year contract, and it dramatically increased workers' wages. It protected them against inflation. It instituted a pension plan, and company-provided health care, and it was a billion-dollar contract. So it was very, very generous package for workers, the likes of which had not really been seen before. He points out that it was basically in exchange, the company regained control, and I'm just quoting here, over crucial management functions, over long-range scheduling of production, model changes, and tool and plant investment. So the day-to-day control over production, control over work and over workflow, the pace of work, what's going to be made and when, everything from major industrial decisions down to what work looks like on the floor, that was captured back by the employer. And, you know, they gave workers a very generous financial and benefit package in exchange. But once you give away that kind of control and that kind of power, it's very, very difficult to get it back. And in fact, as we have now seen in the last couple of decades, there's been a lot of concession contracts, a lot of wage rollbacks, a lot of wage freezes. Once you don't have real bargaining power, once you're no longer waging day-to-day struggles on the shop floor where you're shutting down production if you don't like something, and you're exclusively fighting every couple of years, you know, when you try to bring the membership out on strike, if you even do, when a contract is being negotiated, once you've given up that much of your day-to-day power, the employer isn't as motivated to bargain with you. They're not going to, you know, they're not going to give you as much as you want them to. So really, I mean, I think this is a question of how we conceive of worker power, where we expect that to show up and in what forms.
In doing some reading before this interview, I brushed up on David Roediger's History of the Working Day. And one of the things that he noted that I remember is that a lot of the fights over the length of the working day also resulted in some of these trade-offs where workers who had to work, you know, 12 or more hours a day got an 8-hour day when they put that in terms of a contract that also started to put controls on their on what they had control over during the workday. Now, you mentioned that you lean heavily on a number of historians, and one in particular that I found pretty interesting to learn about was Mike Davis and a pamphlet that he wrote called The Stopwatch and the Wooden Shoe, which the stopwatch refers to scientific management, which was this management theory and movement. It was founded in the early 20th century by a guy named Frederick Wilson Taylor, and it sought to weaponize industrial de-skilling and find other ways to subvert workers' power on the job in line with what you're talking about. And then the wooden shoe refers to the sabot, the classic all-wooden Dutch clog, which workers are said to throw into the factory means, giving us the word sabotage. What about this study, you know, should change how we look at the history of these compromises and what workers had and were giving up at the time?
His pamphlet is really interesting, and it's not that long, and you can find it online in its entirety, and I highly recommend it. And another thing that we've kind of completely forgotten and lost sight of is the fact that there used to be something called the work group. So when you went to work, you were working alongside the same handful of people every day, day in and day out. And as he puts it, I think maybe even quoting another historian, those were like families. I mean, these were people you spent half, if not more, of your waking life with, and you developed bonds with them. And when you had those social bonds with them, you know, you had a bit more ability to dictate what work looked like and to control the work process. And Taylorism, the story that you'll learn in high school economics or a college course or whatever about Taylorism is that it's the scientific management of work, and it was the scientific attempt to figure out how to make work more efficient, more productive, timing processes, you know, separating them out, that whole thing about division of labor. But Davis points out that what it was really about was breaking up the work group, breaking up the social relationships at work, so that, as he put it, the interdependency of workers, previously expressed through their teamwork of conscious cooperation, would be replaced by a set of detailed task instructions prepared by management to orchestrate the workforce without requiring any initiative of the bottom up. So the whole intentional initiative was really about destroying social bonds at work so that the only relationship workers would really have was with their employer. And there was just a natural resistance to this. There was a natural rebellion against this. And so for a long time, in the early 20th century, the struggle was between attempting to rationalize the work process and reinforce the boss's authority, and workers refusing to do that. And there are a couple of great colorful stories in the article about workers breaking their shovel in half when the employer is trying to force them to work faster or harder. And so that was the notion of sabotage that was resisting the Taylorism part.
How did he distinguish different competing meanings of the word sabotage? Because, you know, even to this day, just like the word anarchist, there is this culturally normative association with like something explosive and dangerous and destructive. But that, as you're saying, wasn't the only meaning that prevailed or was in practice. His particular gloss on sabotage and kind of like the political stakes of what that term and the practices that it represented meant, what did he discover about that?
Well, he goes back, as a historian would, and looks through IWW documents and pamphlets and newspapers and speeches at the time. And in that, he discovers a bunch of different meanings of sabotage. There's one, which is the meaning that we tend to have today, where it is like throwing a wooden shoe into the gears to make the machine stop working, where you just basically do whatever you can to interrupt production. But there's, on a deeper level, a notion of workers basically trying to take control back of work. And I think that it's really important, because I hesitated about how to title the piece, and I eventually titled it Big Strikes and the Sabotage of the Labor Movement, first of all, to draw attention to this other sort of history of worker struggle, which was known as sabotage, and also to talk about how those forms of struggle have kind of been undermined by union leadership itself in the last couple decades, which we'll talk about later, I'm sure. But bottom line is, he found one pamphlet that described sabotage as any conscious or willful act on the part of one or more workers intended to reduce the output of production in the industrial field, or to restrict trade and reduce profits by withdrawal of efficiency from work and putting the machinery out of order. So people would literally gum up the works or just fold their arms and refuse to work. Apparently, and this is not just an IWW thing, although the IWW really kind of picked up the banner of sabotage, but workers kind of did this instinctively, where as soon as the foreman turned his back, they would slow down work. And you can find a lot of IWW, they're called silent agitators, so like comics, one panel comics from the time, and pamphlets with imagery of the sabot, the wooden shoe, and that talk about sabotage, that use the word sabotage, because what was an instinct in a lot of ways to workers of not working themselves to death was picked up really as a slogan and a banner by the IWW. Although it's funny, because when I wrote this article, you know, being the publisher of the website, there's no one who really edits me. So I turn hand pieces off to my husband. And when I handed this piece off to him, he said, you know, it's like, now that you mention this, I can't think of a job that I or anyone else has ever had where that's not exactly what you're doing. Like, you try to work as little as possible. That's just the logic of being an employee. You try to work as little as possible. You do it for your own sanity. You do it for your own self-preservation. So anyway, there were kind of social practices in the early 20th century and ways in which workers did this and ways in which they taught other young, you know, workers newly on the job to do this as well, and ways that they coordinated it and ways that they made it practice that formed kind of part of the early resistance of the labor movement.
And as you're saying, this wasn't just the brainchild of the IWW. It was actually this class-wide, if somewhat unconscious, response to the situation of industrial capitalism. And as the saying goes, you know, the struggle creates the leaders. And in this case, it was the IWW that formalized and promoted what the struggle was finding successful.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this widespread practice, basically, of passive resistance. And the IWW was trying to synthesize this as practice and spread it throughout the labor movement.
That's Marianne Garneau, organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World and the chair of the Education Department Board of the IWW, as well as the author of Big Strikes and the Sabotage of Labor, published through her website, organizing.work. Tune in next week to hear our conversation continue. We will be on next week and the week after. This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Ann Feeney, one of labor's great troubadours, died this past week. Here she is with, "We just come to work here. We don't come to die."
Now working in this mill is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. But when I have the time and the proper equipment, I can do my job safely each day. Everybody tells me that they're sticklers for safety. I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
And now, as a follow-up to their recent conversation, Bill Resnick talks again with Al Weinrub about alternative energy systems and the real potential for stopping global warming. Bill?
Hi, Al Weinrub. Welcome again to KABU.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
Al Weinrub is one of the leaders of the community energy movement in California. That movement's goal is no less than demonstrating to the world how to stop global warming by reconstructing the energy system. These public energy programs operate democratically. They're confederated together for emergency help and for emergency storage. They also can work and reconstruct not just transforming energy production and use, but also in the transport, housing, agriculture, other systems, working to transform the way we produce, consume, and live in their localities. Al has tirelessly worked for the last 12 years in that energy democracy movement. He's now the coordinator of the Local Clean Energy Alliance. He also coordinates the statewide California Alliance for Community Energy. He's an activist, builds movements. He also writes and agitates. He co-edited the recent book, Energy Democracy, and also wrote Community Power, a short book, Decentralized Renewable Energy in California, which is available at the website of the Local Clean Energy Alliance. So, Al Weinrub, last week we discussed the rise of community energy in California and the attack on community energy by California's investor-owned utilities. Today we're going to go into more detail on this epic struggle in California. So, Al, you give talks and presentations around the state. How do you talk about community energy and its great virtues, especially as compared to having a few monopoly investor-owned utilities?
Thanks, Bill. I do talk about this a good bit and write about it. Usually how I talk about it and what I say depends a lot on exactly who I'm talking to. In general, everybody understands how crucial energy is to life and human activity and everything we do, and now, in recent years, to the life of the planet as well. The question of how we get our energy, where it comes from, who owns it and controls it, these are all extremely important questions. And historically, at least over the last 100 years or whatnot, the notion has been a centralized kind of energy model where, based on fossil fuels, you develop energy in one place and you use it someplace else. And with the advent of renewable energy technologies, that picture has changed completely to where it's no longer necessary to have remote energy sources, but they can be very close to home, what are called distributed energy sources, meaning that they exist everywhere if they can be harnessed. So obviously that has to do with solar energy and wind energy, but it also has to do with resources like energy efficiency and what we call demand reduction, meaning harnessing energy in a way that doesn't waste it. So the notion of distributed energy has come onto the scene as sort of a technological change that's possible with a switch over from fossil fuels. And so people tend to think about it largely in technology terms, and the notion of an efficient energy system, a brittle energy system, or a resilient energy system have a lot to do with the technology of things. But actually, when we're talking about energy, it's a resource so basic to life that it's really not just about the technology. It's really about, you know, what we're trying to achieve as a society or as communities. And that has a lot more to do with the decision making about energy and who decides what kinds and forms of energy to develop. And that's where the notion of community energy comes in. It's not really a technology thing. It's really about ownership and control of energy resources. And the notion of community energy is that instead of the decisions being in the hands of monopolies and Wall Street, that it can be in the hands of our community. So it's very much about democratizing energy. I mean, that's a term that we've been using for the last half dozen years or so to try to capture the notion that we're not talking about just about technology. We're talking about political and economic structures and who has power and who has power over energy and energy decision making. So that's the basic notion of community energy. Now, what you do with that decision-making power is, you know, then an open question. So the benefits of community energy have a lot to do with what you make of it, assuming you really have some democratic control of energy. So the notion in California of what are called community choice energy programs, which is the main representation of community energy that we have in California, now due to a 2002 law in 2020, roughly 20 years later, we have some 20-plus community choice energy programs where communities have taken over the role of deciding where energy is going to come from for their communities, have taken that role away from the monopoly utilities.
Those utilities now serve what? Close to between 30% and 35% of the total customers in California?
It's roughly on a parity with the investor-owned utilities. So these are the monopoly utilities. Across the state, energy providers fall into a number of categories. The investor-owned utilities are one, and they control about 30% of it. But there are municipal utilities, which are public utilities. You know, that's probably another quarter. And then community choice programs, somewhere between 25% and 30%. But then there are also people who put up solar on their own rooftops and whatnot, businesses. So a certain amount of energy is self-generated as well. So there's a distribution. Currently, the investor-owned utilities only have 30%. And this is largely due to rise of community choice programs, which have cut in.
Right. What happens when people say, well, what about the cost? Is it going to cost me more to go into community choice? And they'll say, well, what about reliability? You know, the big utilities have been on this campaign for many years, and they're continuing, although it's absurd. But it sounds right. The sun only shines a period of the day and sometimes not at all, and the winds are the same. They're intermittent. And we have these plants that will give you energy all day and night long. You can always depend on us. How do you deal with those two arguments about cost and reliability?
Right. You know, I mean, these are technical questions, and we could talk about technologies ad nauseum, but there's no question about the fact that the technologies exist and the methods exist for using distributed energy resources to provide resiliency and to provide stability to the energy system. It's just a matter of putting those technologies into play. And then we get right back to the political and economic questions that I was talking about before. So those are technical questions, and those are technically resolvable. They have to do with where you put investment and how you shape your energy system. And both technologies are available and can be used. The question is which one is going to be used is what's on the table. And that's where the community energy question comes from. Even though we have some 20 different community choice energy programs, since they are all locally governed, they make different choices about what they want to do. So the notion of community choice, it's a vehicle, it's not a destination. And the destination should be decided democratically and publicly. And within that, what you're speaking about is two energy models, you know, the centralized energy model versus a decentralized energy model. And within the decentralized energy model, there are many technological ways of addressing questions of resilience and whatnot. If you want to look at the wrong way to do it, that is a centralized energy model, because we've seen in California in particular what the impact of that model has been. We've had wildfires that have stormed through our communities caused by faulty and defective transmission lines. That's the centralized energy model. We have power being shut off to our communities by the monopoly utilities because it's economically more advantageous to them to shut off power than to have to pay for the damages done by wildfires. That's the centralized energy model. If you look at questions of jobs and economic activity and the things that give communities real resilience, those jobs and that homegrown kind of economic development don't happen with a centralized energy model. So obviously, community energy is all about a decentralized energy model, and the kind of benefits we're talking about is the possibility of real resiliency, the possibility of having really sustainable energy systems where you balance, you know, your use of energy with the capacity of the planet to withstand that assault. You balance energy development to meet the local needs for economic development and stability, and you develop energy in a way that recognizes the historical disparities in which low-income communities and communities of color have basically borne all the negative impacts of energy development and none of the positive impacts, where we can actually increase equity and so on through this model.
Now, right. It seems to me a community energy agency that is having staff there and also be having organizers going out into the community and talking to people and talking to neighborhoods and promoting through the local papers and the local media, not just the advertising, the big utilities, but in fact talking about what ordinary people are doing, as well as talk about the lowering of capital costs for building energy. The less energy you use, the less the cost to the community. That would then ultimately be a benefit to all the people in that community. Seems to me that's so important in stopping climate change, is reducing the use of energy and reducing the capital costs of conversion to clean energy. Is that seen as important?
Yeah, I would say it's hard to speak for what these major institutions are thinking. I can't address that too much. But from a community perspective, what are important priorities is clearly different from organizations that have basically commodified energy and use it as a form of capital accumulation. So what's important to a community has to do with the use of energy, how much energy, the survivability of the planet, the environment that they live in, the ability to get jobs, and so on. And from that point of view, you have a question of cost-benefit that's very different from the cost-benefit. That's the cost-benefit analysis of large corporate energy monopolies. So I'm glad when you asked the question, you didn't talk just about costs, but you talked about benefits. Because what's always argued is that the big centralized energy model of concentrated capital actually produces energy at a lower cost per kilowatt hour. And to a certain extent, that's a valid argument, that when you have rooftop solar, the cost per kilowatt hour are likely to be a little bit higher. but it's only talking about a very isolated set of costs. And from a society, when we talk about cost-benefit, we're not talking about those costs just to producers. We're talking about the overall cost as compared to the benefits. And so the cost-benefit analysis for the community is generally very different than the cost-benefit analysis that you have in the major energy institutions. We've seen the examples of where PG&E, our utility, their cost-benefit analysis is that they're going to take money that's supposed to be meant for the maintenance of transmission lines and keeping them in good shape, and they're going to take those monies and stick them into their pocket because that's the benefit to them, and in the meantime, neglect public safety altogether and burn down and murder communities. That's their cost-benefit analysis. From a cost-benefit analysis in the community, even if the production of energy were to be a little bit higher, the fact that it's local investment, the fact that it's cutting down on the stress to the planet, the fact that it's addressing climate change, all of these things are all benefits that are not realized by the big continual growth, consumptive, centralized energy model. So that's the issue, is the cost-benefit analysis. It's very different from the different parties. And I think people understand that notion, because nobody buys things just on the basis of cost, but what the benefits are for dollar, you know, whether it's shoes or insurance or anything. But the question is, what does it take to really democratize this kind of decision? Because even though you have these public agencies, we know that making an agency public doesn't mean it's really all that responsive to the community and the needs of the community. So whenever we talk about democratizing energy, we're always talking about organizing and organizing in the community. And I just want to make that point, because the different community choice programs in California, they have different orientations. They have different destinations that they're using for this vehicle, and many of them are very close to the centralized energy model. So it takes a lot of agitation, and it takes a lot of public organizing in order to push them in the right direction. They have public boards, but public boards are just public boards. That doesn't mean that they really represent the needs of their constituencies. So I just want to make this point strongly, that what we're talking about is organizing more than anything else. We're talking about organizing the public and our communities around their needs in order to be able to make public institutions act in a way that's responsive to those needs.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Al Weinrub, the coordinator of the California Alliance of Community Energy, that represents more than 20 community energies that now are serving about a third of California electricity customers. Al is one of those people who's trying to push them through to much more public involvement and participation, which is fundamental, actually, to stopping climate change, building models of conservation and use reduction. Now, the investor-owned utilities at first were complacent, which was important. It allowed more agencies to sort of get started. They're no longer complacent. In fact, for quite a number of years, they've been on a furious attack. Tell us about that. Give us a sense of that attack.
Yeah, so here's an example of the importance of organizing in our communities. What happened starting about a year ago was that Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, one of the largest monopoly utility in our state and one of the largest in the country, decided out of the goodness of its heart to offer its nuclear energy, because it owns Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, slated to be shut down in about 5 years, and offered its nuclear energy at a bargain price to community choice energy programs in its territory. And that began a battle that's still going on, but it lasted about a year, in which the agencies themselves said, oh, here's some cheap energy. It's more or less carbon-free, depending on what you really mean by carbon-free, but nuclear is considered to be carbon-free. So let's take this energy. It'll cut our energy costs, and won't that be great? And this was a case where the response of the community was quite different. In the East Bay, in Sonoma, in San Francisco, and on the coast and in other parts of PG&E's territory, people in the community said, oh, no, we don't want nuclear energy as part of our mix. this is outrageous. This is the dirtiest, filthiest, unsafest, most dangerous energy source available. It should be shut down. We shouldn't be taking it. And that ensued a battle in which out of 11 community choice programs in PG&E's territory, 8 decided to reject that offer, but only because the community got riled up and fought against it. So I just want to use that as an example of where the agency under its own guidance can do all the most wrong things, and it's really up to the community to set the terms of what's acceptable and what not.
Al, thanks so much for talking to us.
It's a pleasure, Bill. So thank you much for giving me the opportunity.
Thanks a lot. So long, Al.
Thank you, Bill and Al Weinrub. We are celebrating the life and music of Ann Feeney, who died this last week. Here's just a little bit more from that anthem of the health and safety movement, Workplace Health and Safety, sung by Ann Feeney. The music is called "We Just Come to Work Here, We Do Not Come to Die." Now, I know this song a little bit more from Harry Stamper singing it. As a matter of fact, I had the impression that he wrote it. Harry is a longshoreman in Coos Bay. Right now, this is Ann Feeney's version.
Now, I don't want your chemicals clouding my brain. I want to keep all of my fingers and toes. I want to hear those cheers that pop in my ears when my working days come to a close. I'm not saying that you don't care. I'm not saying that you don't try. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
Now, Another World is Possible. In this episode of Another World is Possible, Luisa Martinez joins me for an all-too-brief discussion of a classic socialist text, Che Guevara's Socialism and Man in Cuba. Che is writing about the possibility of creating a new kind of person, someone who acts differently, who holds different values from the behaviors and values brought out under capitalism. Luisa, one of our themes today, I introduced the entire program by talking about struggle and what can be gained through struggle, even when we don't win victories. In our reading of Che Guevara's Socialism and Man in Cuba, are there insights for us about struggle?
Yeah, he certainly says a great deal. He's constantly deliberating over the question, hence the title of the piece, as a transformation that takes place in society. You know, the role that institutions play, how people relate to them, but then also the process of transformation within the individual. They are both intimately linked, hence the title. And kind of related to this, he touches on overcoming obstacles, right? The struggle with other people to meet goals. And that struggle can be, it could be many things. It could be deliberating how state enterprises will function, or the special period, or Bay of Pigs, or simply, you know, redesigning society to constantly deal with the crippling embargo that the U.S. continues to impose on Cuba. He says it's both an internal and an external process. You know, in the United States, comparatively, it's individualized, right? You just kind of have to, you have to deal with systematic issues as a, just as a person. So he says that it's internal and external process. It's ongoing, but he's also careful not to go into too many specifics about what self-actualization looks like. That's why socialist countries are sometimes referred to as states pursuing socialist projects. There's many layers to it.
Let me ask you a question that I've actually not posed to you before. If you were teaching this text, or if you were using Guevara's Socialism and Man in Cuba with people you're working with here, here and now, what questions does he enable us to raise? Or again, what insights specifically about struggle that people could take away from this text?
That there's different ways of looking at it. And you have to look at struggle in terms of successes and failures. You know, I think one of the points is to provide alternatives. So, for instance, you could look at one that's failed, the July 26th movement, even though it is part of the revolution, right? What is considered a defeat still contributed to the greater public in terms of providing hope in that regard, that this type of thing is, may be possible. So like comparatively, a notable defeat in popular movements, in the United States was the Albany campaign during the Civil Rights Movement. And Howard Zinn kind of contends this, argues back against this framing as the Albany campaign is, kind of a defeat. And he says so in A People's History of the United States. He says that it always seemed to me as a superficial assessment, a mistake often made in evaluating protest movements, that social movements may have many defeats, which is failing to achieve objectives in the short run, but in the course of the struggle, the strength of the old order begins to erode, minds of people begin to change, protesters are momentarily defeated but not crushed because they've been lifted and they've been heartened by their ability to fight back.
Remind us what the Albany struggle was.
It was a campaign to sign people up to vote that was, naturally saw repression, but it was the chief at the time. He did it. He responded to protesters in a very nonviolent way. So you didn't have kind of the same PR around it as you did with other campaigns.
Going back to something you said, Louisa, about the July 26th movement, Che has insights, doesn't he, about the role in struggle of kind of more advanced people. He calls them vanguards. What does he have to say about the kind of role that they can play in our movements? How is that a way of advancing other people's sense of capability, other people's sense of what's possible in the society?
Well, I know you had, an alternative definition, or you have a different interpretation of what he means by vanguard. Could you kind of give that?
I think people right now, when they hear vanguard, tend to think of political parties, Leninist organizations, basically, small group of professional revolutionaries who then would basically be in a position of directing other people. Vanguard has a broader meaning, and I think this is what Che has in mind, although in the Cuban context, he tends to conflate the two. But what's useful for us is thinking of vanguard as simply people who are partway along the path toward being these new people that will flourish under socialism. So basically, people we call advanced workers, or the kind of people when we go into a workplace or we go into community organizing situation, the kind of people we turn to who both other people listen to, that is the influencers, but people who also manifest kinds of values, an appreciation for collective action, for instance, an unselfishness, and a vision even that's different and better than what exists now. So those are the kind of people that I think of as vanguard and that I think he's talking about.
Yeah, I think that's right too. And I think it goes back to the original thrust of the piece, which is that it's a process, right? And it is an experiment in creating a society democratically that facilitates that type of development. And yeah, naturally, some people are going to be a little bit more far along than others, but it's still a process that involves everybody.
That's a very good point, actually. And it's an additional point to what we've been saying. His emphasis is on an ongoing process. There's no sense that you have a revolution and it's a few days, it's the barricade, or a year or 2 years, and then the revolution somehow is over. For Che, and for the Cubans for that matter, the whole notion of revolution is ongoing. The revolution is a capital R and continues in the process of transforming people and creating this new person that he aims at is ongoing. And the question for us is both what all goes into that, and how in our own practice we can promote that.
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think as socialists, we often misrepresent socialism by giving this impression that it's when the government does stuff for you. But, we also have to understand that building a social welfare state, what socialism has to offer is just simply building a social welfare state is, you know, a tactical decision as well. So, you know, when you're talking to working class people, they're probably not going to be particularly interested in hearing about how amazing art is going to be once we're no longer alienated from our labor, right? I think they're, I might be more focused a little bit more on the $20,000 they're paying a year in healthcare, in childcare, or healthcare for that matter. You know, taking that type of path with, when we're talking about socialism with working class people, it has benefits and it has limitations. Certainly it internally, right? We're part of organizations made up of community organizer, but organizers in the socialist tradition, it hampers our ability to have these discussions internally, because then we're turning inward this idea that, yeah, socialism is just when the government provides for you.
Or of course, just when material conditions change, that is when people do have health care, when they do have adequate food, etc., that automatically brings a change in consciousness. For the longest time within Marxism and Marxist tradition, there was that sense that the underlying economy would bring about an automatic change in what was called the superstructure, people's ideas. And we know that that's not true, that as we bring about those changes in the material conditions in people's lives, that there requires a conscious effort as well to affect people's, again, sense of their own capabilities to participate in shaping the society, in developing new skills. Che even talks, doesn't he, about the transition to capitalism and how it was not only a forced transition from feudalism, from traditional values, but that there were intentional efforts to change people's values and their sense of hierarchy, for instance, and the way that theology functioned or the way that the press functioned at that time. I take it that the lesson there also is that we need to engage in a conscious process as we work with people in struggles now about the conditions of their lives. We need to engage in a conscious process to change values and to change senses of capability, etc.
Absolutely. I mean, he had the clarity of mind to scrutinize what he calls the dull instruments of capital. And one way he does this is by emphasizing technology. And this is, of course, borrowed from Soviet thinking. You know, emphasizing technology both as a way of participating in global commerce and providing education, both formally and informally, to the population of Cuba. So I think most obvious example is, you know, the Cuban medical system, the fact that Cuba has three times as many doctors per person as the United States does. Now, that's one way of educating the population. But then, you know, that kind of investment in healthcare and the healthcare system led to medical tourism that supports the island to this day. I think it's something like 13% of GDP. And yeah, I mean, part of it is this, included in the discussion is how institutions can be transformational. Talks about the education system as well.
Good. Then a last quick question, and that's, in your own organizing activities, in your activism, what do you find useful from what Che had to say?
I think taking it back to this question of, well, this emphasis on the transition, right? In that, not to get too high-minded about it, but socialism is a spiritual process, right? As an individual, how it transforms, ideally transforming people's values when they're no longer kind of spending their days and nights just trying to survive.
And any particular insights? Or maybe let me say a couple of things then about what can happen within struggles when our objective is much more than and goes beyond the changing in immediate conditions. And that's, among other things, a need for an explanation on the part of these advanced workers, these people we're talking about as vanguard, these people who are partway toward the new person that Che is talking about. That's a need to constantly point out that the grievances we have within this society can't be resolved simply by improving to some small extent people's material conditions, that all the kinds of grievances, all the problems that we see from racism and sexism on to poverty and the various inequities are all linked to the kind of society that we have, and that what we need to be aiming at beyond the immediate victories is transforming that entire apparatus, this entire way of organizing a society. And so the constant explanation as well, not that we're working just on the immediate objectives, but that there's something bigger at stake too, as well, demonstrating some of those possibilities for new values, etc., in our own lives, that that's part of what he means by vanguard. And maybe leave it at there. We've been talking about, Luisa Martinez and I, we've been talking about Che Guevara's Socialism and Man in Cuba. Luisa, thank you. That was Luisa Martinez, and I'm Norm Diamond. Che's emphasis is on the facets of human nature that life in our society, life under capitalism, brings out, not such desirable qualities, and how different facets of human nature, much more desirable, happen through the struggle to overcome capitalism, the struggle to build a much better alternative. Focus on struggle again, kind of our motif for today. If you remember, Joe Clement talked with Marianne Garneau about workplace organizing with a focus on worker power in the workplace. Thanks to them, thanks also to Bill Resnick and Al Weinrub, his guest today, talking about, well, actually bringing us hope about the possibility of overcoming global warming. It's time to say goodbye. I want to thank also our producer today, Patricia Kohlberg. Again, we've been celebrating Anne Feeney, who died this past week. And as we go out, let's go out with a different song of hers, War on the Workers. This is Norm Diamond. Stay safe, stay active. Tune in again next week. And here is Anne Feeney.